A tēnā koutou katoa. A te mea tūtahi tēnei wā, me mihi au ki te tūru, ki te taumata teitei, kā koe tāmati, me tipene. Selwyn, me pita, Steve, the other tipene. But I'll go off program slightly and say that I wanted to mihi first of all to pay tribute to the Dane that's not here, and that this morning today meritana for allowing this opportunity for me to be able to speak this morning, but to also mihi to the women leaders in the room, not least of which I'd like to mihi to Ke a koe Neida, kia ora. Ke a koe Michelle, mihi maira. Me tahi atu o ngā wahine Margaret Kāwharu. Just to say to all the women here today that I was sitting here thinking when Tāmati was talking, because I serve with Tāmati, I work for Tāmati, but I was thinking also of another of Tāmati's colleagues who was and still remains, even in death, a mentor for me, of Dame Mirazasi, who remains the inspirant really for the as yet incomplete claim to the Waitangi Tribunal, the Mana Wahine claim, which I'll get to. I'll talk to that at the end of my kōrero. And I say that because that's the context from which I came into Hui Taumata. You're all aware of my background. If you're not familiar with it, you just Google it. You just go on to the SIS website. And no matter how many employees I've had and no matter how many annual high security cabinet clearances I get, I've found out recently actually that the statute of limitations doesn't apply to certain categories of security clearance, so it's no use anyway. So I say, as I've always said to every employer I've ever had, that my 7 criminal convictions are all my badges of courage. So hopefully when I do get to be, do one day get to be a Dane, they'll have 7 little sisters on there to represent each of those, and te paki o matariki if I'm lucky enough. Anyway, how did I get involved? That is my true context, actually, for eventually ending up at the Hui Taumata in 1984. I went to the Hui Taumata as part of that kind of surge forward from 1981, following those cathartic years from 81 to 83, and that I was on the other side of the law, and that I kept prosecuting my own, not innocence, but my own courage. And I went to Hui Taumata to do 2 things. First of all, to represent a group in Auckland that I'd formed at the time, along with Dame Mira. I'd formed a group to push for the establishment of Te Ohu Whakatupu, a Māori women's unit in the Ministry for Women's Affairs that sadly has vanished. Such is the travesty of many Māori public many directorates inside Māori, inside public service departments over the last 30 years. You've seen them come and go, and that from them. But in 1984, we pushed for, and it was established as the first, and I was originally appointed as the first ever director. And thanks to Sir Tipene O'Regan, I turned that job down and went instead to pursue a career in broadcasting. The other reason why I went to Hui Taumata was to also present a proposal to to establish a Māori television channel. And I'd have to say that since 1984, that's been part of my career, and that both inside and outside of the tent, as Dame Meritana would put it, that the establishment of a raft of Māori broadcasting and really Māori language and identity entities has pretty much been at the core of my career since Hui Taumata in 1984. I worked in the secretariat of the Hui Taumata of the Māori Economic Development Commission, a little wee office in the old Māori Affairs building, you know, the one with the coffin-shaped windows. And first met Tamati after the conference when he came into the office one day to pick up his running buddy and go off on one of his lunchtime runs. And he went, "Oh, where? So I didn't know you worked here." And he went muttering back, and sometime later when they had the drinks on Friday nights, which I have to say that I really went to, that not like Robin, but I remember going past a receptionist, the famous Lally, one day. She said, "No, it's a Rebecca, she's come here." I said, "What?" And she says, "Tamati." She says, "He didn't know that somebody like you worked there, worked under his care, under his watch." And I said, "Oh, yeah, and is there anything else?" And she says, "Oh, I did think to myself, she's one to watch out for." And I says, "Oh, thanks, Lally, we'll kind of go get on with that from there." So what do we do? Well, it was really the engine room. I mean, all of the facts that Tamati has so eloquently appraised you with of the achievements of Hui Taumata. We established a small unit. I think there was a chap called Graham. He was a clarinet player. That was the other resource that was part of the small team. People like the late Dr. George Habib would also come and go out of this little wee hub. The commissioners, of course, Whatarangi, famous, world famous for his hapu guarantees. And I recall very, very recently, of course, the brilliant successes of one of those little hapu that you got in Ngāti Tūpare to Sutumu, to Aropaki Trust, and that posting an incredible profit, as well as the chair of it, Tūmanako Wereta, talking to me about how they gave hapu guarantees. I remember that feature of Whatarangi, when that aspect of the Māori Development Bank, which is one of the kind of committees of the commission that we serviced at the time. And I remember Whatarangi coming up with the notion of hapu guarantees and leaving Mark Preble and I think David Smythe, just leaving them for dead in terms of, you know, how the hell were they going to be able to articulate a hapu guarantee, a collectively owned asset guarantee. How was that going to be validated in terms of the establishment of the Māori Development Bank? So all of these kind of all of this kind of thinking that was being shaped behind the commission's work and the backroom work was some of the work that I was involved with during 1984. But that was more at the kind of soft, very highbrow, well, it wasn't soft actually, it was pretty hard thinking, to nut out, take these kind of very abstract concepts of Māori control of resources and try and put them into a policy context at a time where the public sector itself, the public service itself, was changing so rapidly. But to take them, put them into a context, and then to kind of feed them back out to the many people that had attended the Hui in 84. But all that kind of changed. Why did that change? Well, the secretariat morphed into a project team because we needed a lot more resources than we currently had, and of course, interstage left Sir Widow Gardner, who came on board fresh from the hustings. I think he'd had a barney with Peter Tapsell, I think he was head of civil defence, and had a bani with him, so Ngā Tata picked him up, and he came and he headed out little mana our project team, and instantaneously gave truth to the notion of exponential potential. You are whatever you want to be when you want to be it, and overnight transformed really our little wee project team into a kind of like a special army service team. So overnight we were became the kind of like superhighway before the superhighway was ever invented. And we took up three or four different opportunities. We worked swiftly. We worked very closely with the Board of Māori Affairs, chaired at that time by Sutumu's father, by Sahepi Tehuhu. It had other such venerables on it as, Bert Mackey, who was also on the Māori Economic Development Commission, Nick Tangaroa, who was also on the Economic Development Commission. These are all people that really kind of helped shape, take that communique and put some flesh onto shaping the programs that came from it. But I had the luxury and the privilege of being able to pick what I wanted to do, and Wira delegated me in his own inimitable style the portfolios of enterprise development, Māori access, and to frame and prosecute the case for the establishment of a Māori television channel. And with only one instruction, really, do it. Do it well, account for it, and then to make sure that I engaged with everybody, with every iwi Māori community from the Cape to the Bluff, and to know everything that was going on down the other end of the terrace. And, you know, that became my kind of working brief. We set up a small team. We travelled the length and breadth of the country. We established very quickly some systems which we found that our dear underserviced and under-administered Department of Māori Affairs didn't have operating instructions and guidelines for operating new projects. We established Māori Access Program overnight. Literally, I remember with my colleague Ria Earp, I had to find somebody overnight who could write a cabinet paper as well. We established the Māori Access and Mana Small Business Development Program. That was originally begun as a $12 million devolving fund. Who were going to devolve it to? We had to devolve it, of course, to initially to tribal trust boards. Then that engaged us with a huge kind of discourse right across the country of what was going to be the kind of structure, what were these entities going to be based on. We established three or four programs, the Māori Access Program, the Mana Program. The Mana Program was really a kind of, was what we were gunning for. We, Wira and I had a meeting with Kerry Burke, who is then, I think, the Minister of Employment, Richard Preble. Walked into their office and they said, well, where's your business case for establishment of this enterprise program? I think we'd written the business case on the back of a serviette in the Civil Services Club and trotted back up, got a few statistics. This was in the very rudimentary days of evidence-based policy, evidence-based research policy. Wrote it on the back. We calculated, something like 36% of the youth unemployed in South Auckland were Māori, and that therefore we should have, 36% of X, Y and Z fund. And Richard Preble leans over and says to one of the Treasury officials, oh, what's that? And he goes, blah, 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 I think it's about $82 million. And I says, oh, what? What? That's a year? And he said, well, can you kind of come back with a more substantive cabinet paper? And bang, overnight we had an $82 million program that we had to get some systems in place very, very quickly too. That involved a huge round of consultation. I think in 1 year we literally did do 365 briefings. So one each, one for every day. Lots of cups of teas, and that, no long lunches. They were all speed briefings, and they were briefings of every single iwi authority, every wannabe iwi authority, every Māori entity that had registered themselves as a trust or incorporation. We also established, we wrote the first cabinet paper for the establishment of the now still in existence Māori Women's Development Incorporation, which still funds small businesses to this day under the care of the past presidents of Māori Women's Welfare League. At that time, we also spawned, I was the advocate for the establishment of the, I advocated for the commission at the third channel hearings for the licence to establish what then became TV3. We missed the bid on establishing Aotearoa Broadcasting Service at that time, but in years to come, in subsequent years, that business case was still kept warm for the eventual establishment of the pilot Aotearoa Television and then the establishment Māori Television Channel. So these were the bespoke channels for what we now know as Māori Television. I have to say that Māori Television Service, I absolutely believe that Māori Television Service is the public service broadcaster in the country. We do have a public service broadcaster, and that it has consumed and filled that gap for us and for Aotearoa, for the nation as well. Iwi Māori Radio, 21 Iwi Māori radio stations still exist to this day, well funded, and for the first time in my knowledge, actually, even in subsequent years when I became Chief Executive of Māngai Pāho, pushed very, very strongly for the building a capacity for training our broadcasters. And I notice, thank you to Minister Sharples for finally in this year's budget funding Māori radio for capacity building. You know, 30 years is a long time to wait for trained broadcasters. So those were kind of a few achievements in that at the time. At the same time, it would be really remiss of me to say that, to mention in some detail what was also happening at that time with Kohangareo. Kohangareo was flourishing, doubled, I think, in 84, 85. It doubled the number in 1 year from something extraordinary from 200 to 400, and it just seemed to go in those quantum leaps from 200 to 400 to at peak something like 850 individual whānau. What was kohanga about? Obviously, Tamati's already talked about whānau-centred learning. It'd be really important to talk about our social development entities. Why? Well, because they're the entities, I think, that hold the glue. I see a colleague here from Stats who have just recently produced the Te Kupinga survey, which talks about the latest statistics, Māori statistics, and that which talk about really the importance of social cohesion and of really, really addressing the issues of how do you kind of like, I guess, stitch or glue Humpty Dumpty back together again. I say that because that's a context also into which the discussion about why is it important that we should have both language, culture, a language and culture television channel. Apart from the fact that it's important to, in terms of our identity, accessing, broadcasting our language and that to the universe, it's an important and iconic part, vital part of our identity and of really what makes New Zealand, what makes New Zealand Aotearoa rather than what makes Aotearoa New Zealand. Some might argue, I just want to have a kind of couple of wrap-up comments, and I do want to beg your forgiveness that really that thank you so on for the opportunity, but also the burden of being able to pull together something kind of coherent in 24 hours is a bit of a turnaround, because there's so much there to discuss or talk about. But I rang a colleague up about really what was the, for some kind of salient thoughts about what they did think was the significance of hui taumata. The calls for hui taumata at the time, some might argue that the biggest thing that has emerged over the past three decades since the hui taumata has been the iwi raupatu settlements, with the earliest settled iwi now at significant regional and national scale. Iwi are now more significant than we ever have been for the last 100 years. However, I think that future leaders and the leaders that we that stood on that taumata, at the hui taumata, were leaders that were about preparing ourselves to be able to face the prospect of how we dealt with the issue of maximising both our political and economic resources that we had then and still have now. However, I think that the real, that actually talking about the kind of sexy claims like forestry, fishing, farming and stuff like that, those tangible material things, are the relatively straightforward claims and settlement issues in that to deal with, because they're really at heart about economic sovereignty and about restoring the economic sovereignty of tribes, the capacity to make decisions and that about yourselves, about the assets that you do have. But I think the more vital economic development issues are that we still as yet to confront, and that still stare us in the face since hui taumata in 1984, are the issues that I would call the common good issues. The common good in terms of whānau, not in terms of the entities that we build, but really about putting and gluing healthy families and bringing and having a coherent identity that you can touch, you can hear, you can see, you can feel every day, and that you can see in 100 years' time that we still have a language, we still have a culture, we still have an identity, we still have a whakapapa that makes us Māori, that makes us different. I'm going to wrap there, because I know I've kind of talked over in that a bit, but thanks once again for the opportunity to speak in that this afternoon. If I've missed anybody out in that in the room, I apologise, but thank you once again for the opportunity. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou koutou.